Good morning. This is Right Here, Right Now, brought to you by Right Choice Services. I'm your host, Tim Morrison. On Right Here, Right Now, we interview business leaders, entrepreneurs, and professionals about their work and the book they have written, are in the process of writing, or intend to write someday. My co-host for the program is Stone Payton. He is a vital cog at Business Radio X with his own show, High Velocity Radio. Good morning, Stone.
Well, good morning, sir. I've been looking forward. This is our last, it's my last show.
Well, it's both of ours because Vanessa's taking
next week. Vanessa's doing next week? Yeah. So where are you headed?
I'm heading up to Akron to be with my wife, to be with her mother and with my son.
So we'll come back. We'll come back heavier, jollier, and refreshed for a new year, yeah?
All of that. And do you have your shopping done?
All of my shopping is done, but my wife handles all that stuff. I just show up and look pretty and say, has everybody got something under the tree? And she,
it's a good thing.
And but we're headed down to Key West this time.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, we're going to Pensacola. Then we're going to dart over to Tallahassee for one night at my brother's house. And then the whole group of us, all 10 of us, caravanning down to Key West and bringing in the new year down there.
Oh, man, that'll be fun.
Yeah.
That'll be fun. You will come back, right?
I will come back. And it's my understanding that when I get back, there will be no less than a half a dozen new shows online on the Business Radio X network. So I'm very excited.
Oh, that's amazing. Stuff. That is great. I remember when I think I was number 27 coming online, and you're now over 40.
Yeah. No, that sounds about right. I think we're probably getting real close to the 50 mark, and looking at continuing to open new studios. You know, we got the new 200 Peachtree one up and running.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's exciting stuff.
Beats the heck out of working, man.
Yes, it does. I'm told that. Well, you know, can a business leader or a professional write for the sheer joy of writing? And is such a concept viable? For the most part, folks tend to have not so positive memories of pounding out assigned essays and themes and term papers from high school and college. Writing and fun, or writing and enjoyment, stand as disconnects, as oxymorons for a lot of folks. For some business leaders and entrepreneurs, writing is fun, though, and does bring some enjoyment, and the writing may or may not be connected to business. So today's guests reflect on the writing they do, which provides them with enjoyment and with a change of pace. Now, you know, I usually go ladies first. Well, this is all men today. So we're going to go alphabetically. And that puts Dr. David Galloway, Senior Director with Galloway Consulting, up first. You've got a PhD in psychology. You've also got an MDiv. We like those degrees. I had one of them too. I still have it, I guess. And David spent 25 years as a priest in the Episcopal Church. He has expertise in leadership and transformation. And his work with Galloway Consulting is to drive positive change within healthcare systems. Now, as I recall, you've written a bunch of articles.
Yeah. Yeah, I've written a number of things around leadership in particular. And I really focused on the whole issue of transformation, how that occurs, what are the hindrances to that, and trying to take an inspirational side to that in terms of encouraging that kind of change, transformation, growth.
Well, you probably know I was speaking with the CFO of Galloway yesterday morning.
I did.
And
he's one of my closest friends and a great guy.
He really is. I used to be his pastor. That explains a lot of why he's brought
up. Not a good thing.
So, no, we don't want to claim that too publicly. But Bob and I were talking about this transformation thing, and he said, "What do you know about transformation?" And I smiled at him, and I said, "Walter Brueggemann." And, of course, he went blank. Bob went blank. Yeah. You know what I'm talking about. Brueggemann is a great theologian, scholar, biblical scholar, and one of his major works from the Psalms is on transformation. And he talks about orientation, disorientation, reorientation.
Right. And he's actually taken that from Van Gennep, was the major anthropological theorist who came up with those three. And it was popularized by a guy named Bill Bridges in a book called Transitions, which is one of the key books in my life. And I've used it a lot in the work that I've done. But Brueggemann, an aside on Brueggemann, Walter was a member of my parish. And he was a he won, you know, he's won so many awards, and yes, it was so daunting. Whenever I was ready to go into the service, he would come up to me and don't screw up the sermon today. And
so it was you gotta love that.
A little scary.
Because Walter is a tremendous preacher.
Amazing.
Absolutely,
he's the best I've ever heard. I had him preach at the cathedral here in Atlanta, and he's fabulous. The funny piece is, his cadence, his voice style is like that of George C. Scott, and so he sort of drams it home, and I love Brueggemann.
Yeah, isn't it interesting though? And I find it interesting that when we talk about transformation, you and I can take that step back to our early training and go into that core. The transformation is critical in all of our lives. You deal with it today, though, from a corporate perspective.
Right. The funny piece was, when I got into ministry, the ordained ministry within the Episcopal Church, one of my first experiences was resistance to change. You know, you're trying to move people down track, and yet they're very comfortable. They like it the way it is. In fact, the truth is, every piece of their life is in such constant change. Many times on Sunday, they want everything to stay the same. Mm-hmm. And so I was desperate, and I went to a guy named Daryl Connor and Charlie Watts and talked to them about change. And Daryl had a company called ODR that worked in corporate life, and particularly in terms of acquisitions when there were mergers. And I studied with him for, I guess, a year, and learning change phenomenology and various theories of change. And so then I was able to use that within a local church, and I also was able to, I was called on by the Episcopal Church nationally to work with them in terms of doing some change management, which most people, you would think that in seminary that would be one thing that they would teach young priests, but they don't.
No.
You have to learn it by doing it.
Yes, and absolutely.
So now I'm working with Galloway Consulting, and we do that work in healthcare, particularly healthcare systems, and particularly hospitals, sites of care.
What kind of a setting do you go into then? Do you get called in? Do you solicit your work and hope they call on you, or what? Give us the scenario on that.
It's generally word of mouth. I mean, we have a great brand, and so people know that we provide results. We also provide value because we're a virtual company, and that we're all over the country. We have people all over the country, but we go in together into various sites and provide the service that the transformation service that we're able to provide. We've been able to, we average a 5% growth, margin growth in the places we go. And I always say there are two scenarios that are typical. One is somebody is basically about to close their doors, and they call us at 4 a.m. and say, "Can you help us with that?" So we go blowing in and try to, you know, really help that. The other, which is much more fun, is you have somebody who's really a great leader, and somebody who has, you know, he sort of knows what's going on, but is nearing the end of their career, and they're wanting to leave a legacy, and they know they want to really turn up the volume on their hospital. So they call us, and we go in there. And both scenarios are fun, and I think we do a good job with that.
I heard that rumor, really. Bob was saying that. You know, the other thing, David, that comes to my mind, and I'm skewing this a little bit because of our connection through our theological background. The Niebuhrs always talked about the critical nature of a dialectical tension.
Right.
That's really what Galloway Consulting looks at, don't you?
Yeah. We don't say that explicitly because it tends to
scare
people off.
It scared me
dialectic.
When you said it. Dialectic. I can't even repeat
dialectic.
It.
Dialectic. Yeah, it sounds like some kind of operation. But no, it is that tension. And what we do, we start off with a notion of looking at where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And we take a very careful, I would use the word rabid, look at where the organization is presently. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people tend to try to put a good face on, and they try to spin it mm-hmm. like everything's okay in the company. Well, in healthcare these days, most companies are facing some real crises mm-hmm. in terms of their survival. And so we want to be really upfront about that, and we call the session with the leadership, we call it Confronting Reality. And we're really in their face about where we are and what we have to do. And so here's the past as one side of the dialectic. And yet we're also trying to draw out this notion of vision mm-hmm. of where they want to go. And so that's that tension, which is what I call creative tension, mm-hmm. that produces growth. And the real key in this for us is we have a very tight structure as to how we make that happen over a 9-month to year period. And we monitor and drive the process. The most important thing that we do is to get them to focus on three initiatives, three things they've got to do to make their hospital a better place for care. And so the hardest job I have is making them narrow it down to three mm-hmm. things.
Oh, sure.
And they always fight me on that because can't we do one more? Or can't we add this? Or no, you can't. It's three. It's three initiatives. Mm-hmm. And they, that's what they're going to focus all their attention on. That's to going against the typical trend in hospitals is they will have 12 initiatives, and then corporate will lob 12 more down their throat.
Oh,
and
my.
So they're trying to juggle, 24 initiatives mm-hmm. rather than focusing on the three that mm-hmm. will really make the difference. And so it's what I talk about in terms of they have to decide what they're going to work on. And decide, that little phrase means to kill.
Uh-huh.
Suicide. Homicide, pesticide, that it means kill. So when you decide, you're killing off ideas,
uh-huh.
which most people don't like to talk about that. But it really takes that focus right now, laser-like focus. Whereas in the past, a lot of healthcare that we would see, people want to do good. They want to be noble. They want to care for people.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Taking care of people is one tension. The other tension is taking care of business, and you got to do both.
Mm-hmm.
Or as one sister, she works up in Chicago at a system that I've worked with, Sister Clara. She's right out of central casting for a Polish nun, but she said no margin, no mission.
Wow.
And so Catholic hospitals really struggle with that because they want to take care of people, which is a noble thing. But I sometimes when I'm up there, I accuse them, in Chicago in particular, I accuse them on being on the Blues Brothers business model, which is we're on a mission from God. And so they'll do anything, which is great. But then they call us at 4 a.m. and say, we're about to close our doors.
There is a peculiar image when you talk about Blues Brothers and a nun straight out of central casting.
Exactly. Exactly.
grab that picture.
And in Chicago.
In Chicago.
So who's the most resistant to change in a hospital system? Is it corporate? Is it a certain function or level? Or does it all depend on whose ox is getting gored in that particular change?
Yeah, that's a great point. It really varies from site to site. I have found we're undergoing right now, it's all over the news, the electronic medical records are sort of the hot topic, and resistance there has tended to be from physicians. Physicians who are like my age, in their middle 50s, are looking at probably 10 more years of their practice, and yet we're saying, we're changing the whole system, going from a written orders to a electronic medical record, and there's some resistance there. There's generally some resistance from staff who just like, they've gotten comfortable, they've got a routine, a procedure, and so anytime you mess with that, they're nervous. The other thing in this tough economic time is when we go in, everybody's nervous about, are they going to have a job at the end of the day?
Mm-hmm.
And we really work hard to make the changes so that people don't lose their job. In fact, we try to make it much more efficient, much more streamlined. And in fact, counterintuitively, When you have a more lean staff, you actually the quality scores in the hospital go up.
Wow.
Which is really surprising, but it's true because people work smarter.
How's that? That's a lesson for government right there.
Yeah.
The more lean, the better. I want to ask you about a phenomenon that I think I've seen, but I don't quite know how to articulate it or if it's even accurate. But do you ever find yourself in a situation where the change, whatever it was initially perceived as very positive by at least a subgroup of the population, and darn it, they're not the ones that are resisting it halfway in and maybe even consciously or unconsciously sabotaging it? Have you ever come across that?
Oh, all the time. I mean, that's part of our theory is to expect resistance. And what happens is generally, I call it uninformed optimism. Whenever you go in and you're
I like making, that. I'm writing that down.
That also works, by the way, for marriage.
okay.
But anyway, you make this initiative. Everybody says, "Oh, this is going to be great." Well, they ordered change, and now they have to pay for it. And it's the cost sometimes is higher. It generally, when you make a significant change, it demands a lot of energy, a lot of time, and people are just slammed in terms mm-hmm. of their schedule, and so it's just one more thing to worry about. And so we do find, particularly people who may have had unrealistic expectations, they're the first ones to sort of say, "Oh, why isn't this working?" And the truth is, it is working generally, mm-hmm. but it's a little painful.
Now, if I recall correctly, way back when, you were a grad assistant with James Fowler.
Yes.
He developed the book Stages of Faith.
Right.
I had the opportunity, as I've shared with you in conversation before, to read that when it was in its prototype, should we say. As I'm listening to you talk, David, about what you do now and what I understand Stages of Faith dealing with, which is the psychology of human development and the quest for meaning, that's what you're doing now.
Yeah, I think my whole life has been about transformation, and mm-hmm. I started out academically looking at individual people, and we did interviews about how people make change throughout the course of their life, how mm-hmm. they hopefully develop in mm-hmm. their spiritual life. I went from that to working with couples. I went from that to working with families. I went from that to working with a city when I was in Tyler, Texas for 10 years and basically perceived myself as a therapist for the city.
Oh, my.
And so, it needed a lot of change.
Uh-huh.
And I love the place. It's a great city. But I worked very, very hard to try to move that city along. I then looked at a larger system, which was the Episcopal Church, and tried mm-hmm. to do that work from within. And now my work was in healthcare, which is one of, I think, the most needed change mm-hmm. in our country right now in terms of getting us back on track, so that we're able to provide quality care at a reasonable cost.
Yeah, we like that. We like that. How much writing do you do these days?
I write every day. I write for a blog, and I write for our company. Mm-hmm. We put out a leadership briefing, mm-hmm. and I write just about every day for 2 or 3 hours.
Oh my!
And it's a discipline that I always wanted to be just a full time writer. In fact, mm-hmm. I wanted my son to be the next great Southern writer.
Uh-huh.
And he actually has turned into a poet. He's got an album dropping this Thursday, and he's a fabulous musical writer. But in any case, I always wanted to be a writer, and I did as a priest. I had to write with a deadline every week.
Yeah.
But now it's having that discipline to sit down in front of the keyboard
mm-hmm.
and pound it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I do love it. I mean, I do enjoy it. It's a great piece of my work.
What advice would you give to other business people or people in general who are contemplating writing?
I think the biggest, what I gave the advice to my son is you have to really be disciplined with your time. And that's hard sometimes for creative people mm-hmm, mm-hmm. to put aside the time. But I always remembered that Hemingway had a specific time in the day when he got up, even after a hard night. Mm-hmm. He would get up and he would write for a period of time and just make that happen. And people, I've known people who've done that, who've just given, have gotten up a little early.
Mm-hmm.
They've taken time at lunch, or they stay up a little later.
Yeah.
But they carve out that time and make it happen, every day.
They sure do. That's great. I appreciate that. David, how do people contact you? They want to ask you questions, learn more about what you do. How would they be in touch with you?
Well, they can. There are two email addresses. One is Dr. David Galloway, that's G-A-L-L-O-W-A-Y, at MSN.com. And the other is dgalloway at gallowayconsulting.net.
Okay. I'll give you a chance to say that later on again, but now here comes the question we practiced, all right? Are you willing to stick around while I interview our other guest?
Pregnant pause. Yes.
You wanted to make me nervous, didn't you? Thanks. Well, Brian Johnson graduated from the University of Tennessee, and after he did that, well, since then, he's started three companies. In his first venture, Brian was a partner in litigation technology company in Houston, Texas, and after that company was sold, he was chosen to help launch Law.com. And then departing from technology in 2003, Brian started a construction company that he still runs today. Welcome, Brian.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We're going to be sharing a bit of a secret with the world today, aren't we?
Okay, sure.
Yeah. Not a whole lot of people know that you're writing a book, right?
No, not a lot.
And not only that, your wife knows, but she hasn't read it.
Not one word.
You and I have a commonality there. My wife has yet to read some of my books.
In many ways, Tim, I'm closer to you than I am my wife.
Ooh. So,
or it could be said you know things about me. That,
no. That's it. So how do what triggered your interest in writing?
I just wrote a series of short stories, none of them necessarily related to the next.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it would be a funny thing that happened at work. It might be something that happened, you know, to or of a family member, and I either took it a humorous route or perhaps saw something that maybe meant more, mm-hmm. you know, more touching. And so, piece these together. This manuscript here that I have has taken me literally years to pull together. I mean,
mm-hmm.
It's just been that. It's just been a collection of unrelated stories, and then just more recently under your guidance, been able to pull together some sort of meaning, or perhaps, some threads we've been able to weave through the entirety of it. What's odd is as much as what's in the manuscript, which I think now is 400 mm-hmm. some odd pages.
Yeah, yeah.
There's, I'd say 50%. Well, I mean, another 200 pages that I culled out and just got.
Oh, well, yeah.
Or in another shelf somewhere.
Well, you mentioned a couple of things in what you've shared that I really want to make sure that our listeners grab hold of, and that is you've been writing for years.
Yeah.
And some people have the idea, well, I'll sit down and crank this book out in 3 months, and some people do that, but, you know, sometimes it takes a lot longer than that. The other piece that you mentioned at the end was there's about 200 other pages that didn't make the cut.
Right.
And that's important.
Yeah, and there are some chapters. In fact, when I first met you, mm-hmm. some of the chapters that I gave you just to have you peruse to see, yeah, this guy can actually write, or no, I need to tell him to stick to construction. But some of those chapters, which were my favorite,
mm-hmm.
Didn't make the cut. Because they didn't fit. There was once I decided, okay, these are the kind of generic threads that I want to weave throughout the book,
mm-hmm.
and then those threads became stronger, and we were able to kind of weave them together to type of a braid.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you read the book, and you're able to take it in its full collection, then I think you're able to see that stronger. Then the stories that we called out just didn't fit the storyline.
No, they didn't in the long run. But what was intriguing with me when you and I first met, and it was at the OK Cafe, as I recall, you came in with this stuff, and I thought, oh, man, we're just getting started, and he's got all this stuff.
Yeah.
You really surprised me, and I have continued to be very impressed. The quality of your writing is quite good.
I'm a very impressive person, Tim.
Yeah, well, yeah, I know. I've heard that.
I'm sitting in a room full of PhDs here, so I have to, you know, do everything I can. So.
No, but I got to say, I'm steeled for when I get a pile of papers that somebody has written to think, oh, man, this is going to not be fun. But it has been a delight reading your stuff. What are your plans for it?
I have no idea is the honest answer. We're going to, I've got to get it cleaned up, which you've been kind enough to help with. So I've got some little bit of work left to do. My goal was by the turn of the year, have it in a presentable format to either present, begin the arduous process of presenting to publishing houses or look at an e-publishing or, you know, self-publishing type of method.
Well, what's significant to me in that is when we first met again, you said that by the end of the year you wanted it to be done, to be where you are, and we've done it.
Yeah, my whole life revolves around goal setting, I'm fascinated by Dr. Galloway and the work that he does in transformation, because I'm a, you know, like Rain Man about certain things. One of those things is goal setting.
Mm-hmm.
The main character in the book, you know, is you know, I describe the main character's name as Ken, as if, you know, if Anne Rand and Dale Carnegie had a love child, this would be
this would be the child.
This would be Ken, yeah. And so that's, you know, that's the main character, and there's a lot of similarities that I draw out of my own life from that are in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's much sharper guy than I am, so I don't mean to make too many parallels there, but no, I'm you know, one of the things I do every year between Thanksgiving and Christmas is look at the year that has elapsed, and kind of do a report card on how I did in three very significant areas of my life, and then look and kind of lay it out for what I want to do in the next year, and then you know, I break, God, it really gets much larger than that. I mean, you know, the goal setting process is a lifetime achievement. It's
sure
not
is.
One
sure
year or 1 month at a time. So when you break it, you go in reverse. So you begin with a lifetime achievement and then go backwards from that to where you stand today. And then once you've been able to go through that very long process, you're able to identify what you want to focus on next. So it becomes very simple.
Where did writing creep into your life? You know, I in your introduction, I talked about you were a part of a litigation technology company.
Mm-hmm.
You were a part of the launch of law.com, and now you're a construction person.
Mm-hmm.
Where's writing in all that?
I'm one of the things, if you look at the bio, is that they're always startup companies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've only had an actual job twice in my life. I got fired both times, so that
you learned something then, didn't you?
So I'm very much a startup kind of person. It's just in my DNA, and that loose kind of open architecture, fluid way that a startup company is created, and then matures to the next level where you actually got to have, you know, people who know what they're doing with, you know, management degrees and this sort of thing, running the company. It's right in that transition there that I begin to lose interest. And once it becomes an actual company that is functioning and it's got an HR department and, you know, it's people want, you know, days off, things like that, then I begin to feel like my suit is too small and I need to, you know, change my clothes or something.
Uh-huh.
So that creativeness really is what's there. And so I dabble in art on the side, and God, I hope no one, that my subcontractors aren't listening to this. So yeah, I dabble in art on the side, and I dabbled in this writing, as I said, and you know, the thing.
This I have a quick question. This is a fiction book, right?
Yes.
So those of us that write more in our with on topics that are mm-hmm. related to our work, we know that it impacts our work. Does the fiction writing, does that impact your work at all, you think, or vice versa?
It gets in the damn way, to be honest with you.
Wait, which?
Yes. They both. One gets in the way of the other. You know, the book isn't paying the bills yet, so I've got to.
Do you draw from your experiences at work for the book, and do you draw from the book to influence your thinking or your communication at work?
Absolutely. Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, there are a couple of things that I've taken out of the book and I've applied into my direct professional life and personal life. And then there are a couple of things that, you know, backing up to your question, you know, Tim said, have a conversation with your character. I got hung on something. I didn't know what I wanted this character to do next. And he said, well, just have a conversation with the character. And now you can have a conversation with a fictional character in your truck sitting at a stoplight. I mean, that, you know, it doesn't require any amount of effort. You know, it's a simple thing to do. And then from that, I've been able to take away from what my character kind of said back to me. Here's an example. Because you have to have a difficult conversation with somebody, whether it be a subordinate at work, a partner at work, or your spouse, or one of your children, doesn't mean that you shouldn't have the conversation. It means you just need to, probably more so, that you need to have the conversation. If it's difficult and it's a hard subject for whatever matter, you know, whatever the deal is, doesn't mean it should be avoided. In fact, it's the opposite. It probably has a greater demand on it. Converse to that, back to your question, is that there are several things that I've been able to glean from people that I've been blessed to work with. I've been richly blessed with men and women in my life that I've worked with that I've been able to learn a great deal from. And I've been able to put that back into the book. It's been a tremendous experience. You know, that for years and years and years, it was nothing but a fun distraction. You know, the wee hours of the night when I was dealing with insomnia, or if I was on a vacation and I just had free time on my hands. You know, more recently, just in the last year, with Tim's help, we've been able to mold it into something that may have an impact. Hopefully, we may have an impact.
I think it will. It's just powerful. You know, Stone, you and I often talk about the synergy that develops in these radio shows. And, right. You know, I've known both of these gentlemen for a year or so and asked them both to come on today. And I'm just absolutely intrigued by the similarities, you know, David with your transformation background and Brian, you like to go with startups. And, you know, I in ministry was dealing with transformation, and most of the churches that I served were startups. You know, I just can't go. When you talk about when it begins to have an HR department and all this, it's time for you to move on to something else.
Yeah.
When a church starts functioning and says, okay, now we're real and now we can take it easy, I'm out of there.
Right.
Well, I've just kind of segued us in to open up. But before I do that, Brian, people want to be in touch with you. How would they be in touch with you?
I think they should call David. That's what I think they should do.
Thanks a lot, Brian.
And David has all of my contact information.
So. Oh, no.
He is a broker. At 10%, is that what I
get? It sounds great. Yeah, that's a deal. I'll take it.
I'm your new agent.
Well, I don't know. You know, like, as you know, I run a construction company right now, and unless you want me to build something, I'm not going to be much help to you. But
there might be somebody listening that wants to ask you a writing question.
I have an email address. It's bjohnson@jcatgcm.com.
Off on two.
Yes.
Okay. I just have a feeling that one or the other of you is just chomping at the bit to raise a question or create havoc. I'm not sure which.
I think it's absolutely David's turn now.
No, it's interesting listening to Brian, because I think one of the things I think I do in working with leaders in healthcare, and I found that to be true in church work as well, but... you know, when you're hired to do a particular job, you're hired because of a particular and peculiar constellation of gifts that mm-hmm. fit the need of that community for that time. So they bring you in. The problem is people think they should stay there forever, and they have a really hard time with their pride and understanding that the thing that made you good at one season of an organization's life may be the worst thing for the organization in the future.
That's a great point.
Yeah. And so when people ask me at cocktail parties, they say, what do you do? I said, well, I teach executives how to tell time.
Whoa.
They to be able to see where you are in the process and where the organization is and what the needs are, I think it's readily apparent to somebody who's an objective observer. Mm-hmm. But when you're embedded in the system, you really have a hard time to find those eyes. You just don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the things we do. I'm working with a guy right now in Chicago that's been the COO of one of the biggest hospital corporations in the country. And he really needed to see that this was a time for him to make a move.
Mm.
And that requires courage. Mm-hmm. It requires a lot of resolve mm-hmm. to make that kind of move, particularly when there's security involved. And yet he's been able to do that, and he's in the process of writing a new chapter in his life. And that's fun for me. And some of it's hand-holding, and some mm-hmm. of it's encouragement. But I really do think that, you know, in our lives, there's so many transitions that need to occur, and we just have to really pay attention to that. I really loved your, Brian, your comment about looking every year and doing a review. And having what that's called in the field is called self-awareness.
Mm.
And it really makes the difference. It's really the key piece, I think, of being a human being, is being aware and being able to take that meta step, to step away and see your life and see what you're doing and make some decisions around that.
You know, something that touched me whenever you were talking and was the comment you made a moment ago about being in constant, we are all as human beings, we're in constant transformation. We're constantly. And I think, and I can remember back, and this is an actual very specific piece of, I don't know that this actually made it to the book. I probably should include this somewhere. But despair is a liar. And the lie that despair tells is that you are not going to change. The fear, the awfulness, the place that you're in right here, right now. Pardon me, Tim.
I like it.
Right here, right now. I didn't mean to make a fun word there, but the spot that you're in will never change. It is the definition of who you are. It is the culmination of your actions to date, and that is a lie. The real truth of the matter, and I say that with a capital T, and I'm not a preacher, I never have been, and not, you know, educated to be, none of those things. So I'm not trying to be religious. I'm just saying that the capital T truth is that we are in constant motion. We are in constant evolution and transforming. And, you know, I have two young daughters, and one of the things that they struggle with is change, as I think all children do. And I say to them, well, you're in fourth grade now. Why don't we take you back to first grade? Would you like to go back to first grade? And does it make sense for you to be back there doing that work? Well, no, it doesn't make any sense at all. Well, of course it doesn't, right? Because you're moving forward. It's the natural progression of things. And that doesn't mean it's not scary sometimes.
Right.
But despair is a liar, and that's the lie that it tells, is that you're not going to change, that this is where you're stuck in. But forgive me.
I like that you
had mentioned a moment ago. I wanted to.
Well, in my work when I was a therapist, that's the one. I love the way you frame that in terms of despair. But I used to, this was back in the age of VCRs. You remember those?
Mm-hmm. I do.
But
remember
anyway,
those.
There was a thing called freeze frame.
Mm-hmm.
Where you could stop it, you know, could stop the action. And that's what I sometimes use that image working with patients around the notion that they felt like their life was in freeze frame. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, they couldn't go back and they couldn't go forward. They were stuck. And so the image of a narrative that continues on, that life does, as you say, does change. It's one of the key in religious thinking, in all religious thinking, but one in particular in the Buddhist tradition, the notion is life is always change, and change involves sometimes suffering,
mm-hmm.
because you have to let go of some stuff that was very meaningful to you, but it still moves forward. And you know, the old line is, you know, the only, you know, constant is change,
mm-hmm.
and that just does take place. And your wisdom there, Brian, in terms of
easy. I don't know that I would use that word.
Wisdom.
easy.
Easy, buddy. But anyway, wisdom is the notion that that is the nature of life. That's the lay of the land of being a human being, which is change, and it's going to happen. You are going to change, and to try to pretend that you're not is really an illusion. It's a complete illusion.
Well, let's take that, David, and I'm going to turn to you, Brian, and say, you said earlier that when the clothes get tight, you go look for something new to do.
Right.
Your work history of the three companies you've started, I think the first two we can see some similarity, but construction, how did that come into the horizon?
Well, I'll tell you, you talk about change and transformation. That's an excellent question, because after Law.com was sold, and it was sold in a fire sale, so I made pennies on the dollar, and I took my daughters to Dairy Queen with the payout that I made.
Mm-hmm.
I made my stock was worth $38, which they took capital gains out of. And and so I got a check for like $24 after we sold that company. And I took Madeline Grace and Olivia Sinclair to the Dairy Queen down the street. And I remember sitting there thinking, all right, well, what am I going to do now, right? And I was picked up by a offshoot of Law.com is another legal technology company, and I was working with them for about 6 months. This is one of the jobs that I had that I got mm-hmm. fired from because I was awful at it. They should have fired me. It was terrible. So my suit was too small. It was driving me crazy. So during that window, I was miserable, absolutely. And I thought to myself, okay, if I could do anything in the world, truly anything, no box, no strings, no preconceived notions, not what I'm educated for, not what I'm, not what my experience leads me to this point. If I could do anything in the world at all, what would it be? And in a moment, I mean, I was brushing my teeth on a Sunday night. It was like around midnight, and brushing my teeth, and I'm sitting there thinking, I'd run a small construction company. That's what I would do. And that's like saying, okay, well, you know, I've got a mortgage, I've got children, I've got private school, and I should move to Greece. That's what I should do. Never mind the fact that I can't speak Greek. This makes sense now. This is what I should do. And so I sat down at the kitchen table. I did have some experience in startup businesses, mm-hmm. so I understood the process of what it took to start one. So I sat down at the kitchen table and over a weekend and began a Memorial Day weekend and began putting the business plan together. You know, how it would make money and, you know, what services it would provide, all these sorts of things. Then I got the Yellow Pages back in the day when we still had Yellow Pages. And so I began calling the target market right out of the phone book. Hey, if I, you know, you don't know me from Adam, and if I started this company, does this sound like a service that you would use? And I began to do the research that way. And then rather surreptitiously, I got fired about 2 months later. And by then, I had enough of the program fixed in my head. I knew what I wanted to do. And so I took a second mortgage out of the house and rolled the dice. And that was 8.5 years ago.
Wow.
So that's I don't exciting. Recommend it. I don't think it's what everybody should do. Please don't take my advice. Don't do this.
A disclaimer out there, right?
Yeah. It's
well, you know, the clock is on us as a often happens in all of these shows, and we welcome your comments and suggestions about the content and our guests. If you'd like to recommend a guest or be a guest yourself on Right Here, Right Now, let us know and send us an email at whwnbusinessradiox@gmail.com. Thank you, Stone, for co-hosting, keeping me on track, and throwing in some comments. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for letting me play.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you to our guests, Dr. David Galloway and Brian Johnson. David, your contact information again.
It's Dr. David Galloway at MSN.com or dgalloway at gallowayconsulting.net.
And you know what's coming, Brian. It's your turn.
I know. I just am very poorly prepared for this. All right, so I'll get the email address again. Is that
yeah,
okay,
yeah.
So it's B. Johnson, and then the at symbol, and the suffix is jcatgcm.com.
Okay.
Which is jcatgcm.
Okay. Well, Right Here, Right Now is brought to you each week by Right Choice Services. Learn more about Right Choice Services at www.rightchoiceservices.com. I hope you will join us next week and tell your friends about the show. In fact, send them an email right now to invite them to listen live or to the downloads. Right Here, Right Now broadcasts live every Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time at righterightnow.businessradiox.com. And the MP3 version is available later today. I am Tim Morrison. Join us next time when business leaders, entrepreneurs, and professionals come together to discuss the power of the pen and its impact on their business, right here, right now.